Welcome to the KGP Cine Horizon podcast. My name is Kay, a story writer, film researcher, and avid horror aficionado. On alternate Wednesday nights at 10 o'clock London time, I will be rigorously focusing on every aspect of cinematic horror with interviews, analysis, and short stories. Join me in untying the soul's strings of darkness, exploring the human mind's abyss and their filmic psychological projections. Tonight, I am interviewing Dr. Neni Panouria. Dr. Panouria is affiliated faculty at the program in Hellenic Studies. She is an anthropologist, associate professor at the Prison Education Program Psychology Department, and academic advisor at the Justice in Education Initiative at Columbia University. She is the incoming co-editor of Anthropology and Humanism. Her essays on anthropology, ethnography, critical theory, art and architecture, critical medical studies and politics qualify her tonight to talk about the origins of the prison system in the US and how that has affected their current but also futuristic cinematic depiction. Without further ado, here's the interview. Hi, Dr. Panouria. Thank you very much for coming on my show. It's an honor to have you here. Can you please tell us a few things about your work at the Prison Education Program and at the Justice in Education Initiative at Columbia University?
Yes, thank you very much for having me here today. And I do appreciate what you're doing. I think it's very interesting and very important. So the Prison Education Program is one of the programs at the Justice in Education Initiative at Columbia. The Justice in Education Initiative, JIE, is a large initiative that is being funded by the Mellon Foundation and has a number of programs within it, one of which is the Prison Education Program. The JIE initiative is sort of not a clearinghouse, but it is a large umbrella that is committed to prison education and the education of returning citizens. So as a program in general, as an initiative, what we do is that we make educational opportunities available at Columbia, available to people, to returning citizens. And we do this by admitting people who have come home from prison through a series of interviews. So people who are being admitted to the program go through a rigorous educational interview process. And we have to make sure that the program is right for them, and we have to make sure that they are right for the program. And we put them through, they have three gateway classes that they have to take. And one is in writing, another one is a sort of grid books with a twist class, another one is an introduction to Columbia and how one can make the transition from prison education to on-campus education. And if they get a B+ or above mark in these courses, they can then start taking classes at Columbia under advising. So they cannot just take any class that they want, but we create a curriculum for them that has an eye with an eye towards their wider and long-term educational goals. So we don't allow them to take, let's say, neuroscience or astronomy or differential mathematics unless we know that they are able to do well in class, which means in those classes, B+ or better. So we advise them very conscientiously and with a commitment towards their educational goals. And those classes are free for them. I mean, they don't have to pay tuition. They're free of tuition. They're free of fees. We support them with tutoring and everything that happens at Columbia on campus. Of course, all this is pre-COVID. It is open to them. So they can go to any lectures or seminars that are being run anywhere on campus. if they do well in those classes, then they can actually apply to become part of the general student population at Columbia, so the general studies and a BA in at Columbia, because from that moment onwards, from the moment that they get accepted to the regular program, their tuition is not free any longer. So they have to find ways of financing their studies. Some of them get fellowships and scholarships. Others decide to take loans. But others decide to go to different educational institutions. So they go to either to state institutions or other private institutions around the state or elsewhere, depending on their parole, where they can actually financially they can afford it. We have some students who have come already with their BA degrees, and I will get to that. And those students go on to master's programs, some of them at Columbia, or others we help them enter master's programs elsewhere. And we continue to advise our graduates, right? So JIA scholars remain JIA scholars for as long as they want to take classes at Columbia, but they never really leave our family, so to speak, right, our community. So even when they take classes elsewhere, they still come here for advising, for additional advising than the advising that is being made available to them through their schools. So I do all that advising for our JIA community. Part of the other part, another program of JIE is the Prison Education Program. And that is a program that started in as a pilot program for a master's degree at Sing Sing, got started in 2014, and I taught there the pilot courses. We haven't been able to put together, not for lack of trying, but we haven't been able to put together a master's program through Columbia, but we do participate in the BA initiatives at various prisons in New York State, both state prisons and federal prisons that are within New York State. We're not a degree granting institution. So within the prisons, we have to collaborate either with Mercy College, which is one of the degree granting colleges, or with BPI, which is the Bard Prison Initiative through Bard College, or through Marymount College, or through the New York Theological Seminary. The New York Theological Seminary is the only educational institution in New York that actually can grant a master's degree, and that only at Sing Sing. In 1995, the Clinton administration withdrew the Pell Grants that had been made available to in-prison educational programs. So all programs that were within prisons at that time had to withdraw. And a group of de-incarcerated people got together and put together a new program that's called Hudson Link, that actually petitioned with various educational institutions in the state to start teaching again through private grants. So there is no federal support yet. There will be with the Biden administration, Pell Grants will be reinstituted. But since 1995, there has not been any federal support for prison education. So the prison education that we offer at the three prisons right now, S. Columbia, at Sing Sing, at Taconic, which is a women's prison, and at the MDC, the Metropolitan Detention Center, which is a federal prison in Brooklyn, all that is being supported through the Mellon Foundation grant that we have that is being administered through the Justice and Education Program. So what I do inside prison is that I teach, sometimes I teach general social sciences classes, but most often, as an anthropologist, I teach anthropology classes at, as I said, at Sing Sing, occasionally at Taconic, and we tried to get into MDC Brooklyn last year, but we were only there for a month and a half before COVID came. So we moved our classes online, but not for the incarcerated population. So the classes that we were teaching last spring, we moved to JAE. So I know, incredibly arcane and Byzantine it sounds, but it would probably give you a sense of how difficult it is to teach in the prison system in the United States. It's incredibly difficult and arcane process. So now that Sing Sing has sort of opened again, I'm teaching there in a very anti-pedagogical manner, I would say. We have to send in written lectures 4 times a semester, and then the students read our lectures and read the readings that we send and do the assignments that we give. And then the clerk sends the assignments back to us at Columbia, I mean, on campus. And then that gets disseminated at home from where we teach. And then we respond to the prisoners' assignments. And then we send those responses back in. It's incredibly, people who are in prison really need to have contact with the outside, and they need to be engaged in any form of instruction. But it is a terribly archaic way. Well, no, I didn't mean archaic, because archaic education was actually peripatetic. You would see your students and walk around in the city, right? It's not even medieval. It's just an incredible inhumane way of teaching. So that's where we are right now. Right now, I teach a class that is called Man Machine, and it is about the ways in which human beings have been thought of as machines, both in post-humanistic and anti-humanistic writings, but also in sci-fi.
I will make sure to include all the relevant links on my website, so thank you very much for that. What are the differences between jails, prisons, and correctional facilities? Is penitentiary a North American term for one of the three?
All of them are penitentiaries, which is a very old term. I think it appears first in terms of prison confinement. I think that it was first used by Jeremy Bentham in his Panopticon writings. But it is penitentiary is a fundamentally theological term. It is a term that connotes that confinement actually invites the action of penance. So the action of actively asking for forgiveness, submitting to the knowledge that you have committed a crime and that you need to ask for forgiveness. It's a very formal term that is still being used. Prison, on the other hand, is a very informal way of indicating a correctional facility. So a prison is not being used in any formal documents any longer. Guards want to be called correctional officers at a correctional facility, hoping in that sense, I think, that they will invoke the rehabilitative and correctional ability of the prison of confinement, which of course is a misnomer, as I think we all know, at least as far as the United States are concerned. Jail is the term for the place that actually holds pre-trial people. So people who have been indicted and are waiting for their trial are being held in jails. And once they are sentenced, they're moved to a correctional facility, which probably you and I would call prison, which is a penitentiary.
The penitentiary doesn't really reflect on what you do, though. Maybe the correctional facility does, so they might be the same as you claim, but it doesn't sound like it.
I don't think that there is a doubt about the fact that correction in or rehabilitation in the prison system happens through education. So the prison system itself, even though it's being called correctional and it contains the notion of penance, it actually not only does not engage, but oftentimes it makes more difficult, far more difficult, the process of education and rehabilitation. So all educational and rehabilitation programs that try to teach inside the prison system have to jump through a number of hoops, lots of hoops, actually, in order to be able to teach inside the prison. There are certain programs which have managed to gain the trust of the system, and those are Department of Corrections mandated programs. So these are programs that are alternatives to violence. There are family rehabilitation programs. There are a lot of religious programs. But those programs are, as I said, they are mandated by the Department of Corrections, and prisoners have to take them, but that does not necessarily mean that they really gain much out of those programs. The only thing that actually really helps prisoners rehabilitate themselves are the different educational programs, which are very few. And I mean, to give you an example, Sing Sing has an inmate population of about 1,300 people, of whom about 50 participate, are allowed to participate in the educational programs. For any prisoner to participate in any educational program, one has to earn it. So, and one has to earn it through behavior, and at any given moment, any behavior infraction can actually result. The first thing that it results to is the disallowance of participation in the classes that the person is enrolled. So, of course, what we try to do is that we try to rehabilitate in the deepest sense of the term, right? To rehabilitate the person to become, again, part of society and correct their behavior. But this all become, on a very large scale, they all become simple words rather than terms that are inhabited by notions that actually support them, right? So they do become empty words, naked words. They are words that are being used by the state or by the Department of Corrections only to be performed.
The future is often portrayed in thriller or horror sci-fis as dystopic and the prisons as hell on earth. What do you think that means? That society has collapsed because the law didn't protect it? Societies globally defied the laws? The laws were cruel, inspiring unmitigated injustice, and people rebelled against their governments? Something else?
What is a reason for dystopia? I keep thinking, I keep going back to the Godzilla movies. When I was a child, we were watching them with a feeling between mirth and horror, right, both. As children, we were frightened, but also they were so outlandish. It was ridiculous. It was not until much later that I actually found out that the Godzilla movies all have to do with the nuclear destruction in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And that was sort of a metaphorical presentation of nuclear horrors. So there we have a complete destruction of society that rightfully, actually, produced a dystopic image of the future that was very much the presentation of a very real and very recent past. But if we think about the dystopias that in literature or in film that are being presented now, I think that we need to go back and we need to think about all the real lived dystopias that humanity has gone through. So it's not that human societies have actually collapsed, it's that human societies are still a work in progress. So the unknown of the future becomes the dystopia that is being represented in horror. That's the one thing. The other thing, I think, is that there is, I mean, if we think about the African American experience, and if we think about the Japanese society prior to World War II, or the awfulness of living in under conditions of utter abjection, then I think that we can think, that we can see that what is being portrayed as the dystopia of prison in film and the arts has somewhere, at some point, already existed in a different form. In other words, the dystopia we see is in representations, in artistic representations, is nothing compared to the dystopic realities that have existed or still exist.
Why do you think then that the prisons or the correctional facilities portrayed in such manner as this grotesque version of how they are in reality? Even though it does make some sense in a way that societies seem to have collapsed and these prisons are inundated with the worst people ever. They are portrayed as places though where the system shoves people in, stuck one on top of the other, and rehabilitation is nowhere to be found.
Well, prisons are awful places. When we think of prisons, we should not be thinking about the Norwegian or the Swedish models or the Swiss. I don't know. Are there Swiss prisons? I'm sure there are. But that's not what prisons look like anywhere else. Prisons are awful places. They are places that bring out the worst in even in the best people. And that goes both for the prisoners and the guards. I don't think that prisons are the places where the worst of humanity goes. I think that plenty of the worst of humanity is still outside of prisons. Prisons are places where the most unfortunate people go, those who get caught, not those who are really awful. But we cannot think or talk about prisons without thinking or talking about the social context of that actually produces crime. And here we'll make a very rigid distinction between white-collar crime and non-white-collar crime. White-collar crime, which is being driven by greed, and non-white-collar crime, which is being driven by desperation. So we just need to think about that difference. You know, there are way too many laws in the world, way too many laws in the world that should make crime disappear. Laws against hungry children. There are laws against separating families. There are laws against preferential treatment of criminals. There are enough laws in the world to make this world run well. But the laws are always interpreted, and they are being interpreted by judges who carry with them their own personal ideologies and their own personal biases. That's the one thing. But the other thing is that we live in a world where systems of exception and social excision govern. So the problem is not a legal problem. The problem is widespread and rampant racism, displeasure and disgust with poverty, with rampant xenophobia. Those are the things that actually make, I think, the construction of the mass incarceration that has been going on ever since the Reagan-Thatcher culture wars started possible. And they are the ones to which the dystopic presentation of the future is in constant dialogue with. So Kiddick's writings are all in direct communication and dialogue with all these conceptual systems of exclusion of mass numbers of humanity. The Invisible Man, you know, Ralph Ellison, Lovecraft, right? All these are all attempts to address these exclusionary systems of thought.
I take particular interest in H.P. Lovecraft, and it is in my immediate plans to have an episode or more on him examining his way of thinking and developing his own mythology. Going back to who we're talking about, though, do you think that these futuristic prisons are based on today's real-life models?
You know, my students will say that no matter what is presented in film, it can never match the reality. I don't like horror. I don't watch horror. It's not something that speaks to me, precisely because I think that it tries very hard to create a dystopia that is already here. It puts it into the future. It is not necessarily unavoidable, but it is something that we can actually try to stay away from. But it is always here. It is always here for someone else. It's already here for a lot of other people other than us. So we sit in a movie theater, or we sit at home and watch a horror film, or we are in bed and read horror literature at night, and brings up all these emotions and fear and fright in us, without actually thinking that there are people out there who are actually living something which is very, very similar to it. By postponing the encounter and moving it into the future, we're not actually doing anything about the present. Every time that I see something, a representation of prison in a film or in a series, it's always so stupid, because it's always made to look awful, right? With water running from the walls, and, you know, bare concrete floors and concrete blocks. And that's what prisons are like. That's what they look like. That's exactly what they look like. Right? I mean, there's nothing that can be made look worse. A political prisoner in Greece who was first imprisoned when he was 16 years old in 1967, he said to me, you know, it doesn't matter whether there is a door or a wall on the cell. The door never has a handle on the inside. There is never a doorknob on the inside of your door. So it doesn't really matter whether that is a door or a built-up, blocked-out cell. The prisoner can never cross that threshold. The prisoner can never leave the cell on his or her own accord. We have to start from that very seemingly minute but essential detail when we think of it, when we talk about the representation of prisons. In the prison, you're always watched, even when the cell door is closed. There's always a sense that everybody knows what you're doing. And that's not a matter of privacy. It's what, as another one of my students said, you cannot actually think because you think that your thoughts are being heard.
Following up on your comment about how all prisoners are being constantly watched, here in the UK, it's not really that different in the outside world, as we are constantly being watched everywhere. Anyway, Minority Report is not a horror film. It includes, though, at least two horrific and terrifying scenarios: a prison based on statistics, and a government fully authorized to invade homes at will. The former is more fictional than the latter, even though pre-crime technology is already out there, but is the world heading that way?
Okay, you know, Minority Report is not a futuristic film. This happened. It has happened. Every time when there has been a dictatorship that has actually decided that they were going to persecute thought and not action. This was precisely the law of 1929 in Greece, the famous or infamous Ideonymon, that actually criminalized ideas. So you didn't have to have actually acted upon anything. The secret security could actually, and did, walk into your home in the middle of the night, and they could haul you away, even though you had not done anything, simply because you had been associated. You had talked to someone at the street corner, or you had read the wrong newspaper, and you were hauled away, and you were sent away to exile, or you were tortured. This thing has happened. Minority Report has happened. It's not futuristic. As I was watching it, actually, when it first came out, I was watching it and I was thinking, have these people not read any history books? We have seen it in the Soviet Union during the Stalinist era. It happened in China during the Cultural Revolution. It happens in Afghanistan. It happened in the United States with the Patriot Act. It has happened in Ireland. This is not something that is foreign to the future. This is something that has come deep into our 20th century history.
That is a very interesting association. This means that prisons, such as the aforementioned, are associated with government experiments. This fictional futuristic topic is based on actual events of the past, is it not?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Experiments cannot be run in prisons any longer. I mean, what am I saying? I don't know. Right, because they would be secret. They would be secret. Scientific experiments, you know, from universities that have to run through IRBs and things, these things cannot happen. But, you know, it's a lot of times, very often you hear people say that the prison system itself is an experiment, is a social experiment, but it is not any longer. Even if it was an experiment, even that perhaps give it some validity. It's not even an experiment. It's just a system that piles people upon people. I had a student in my class at Sing Sing. He was serving 32 years to life for having been found with 32 ounces of marijuana. Now, 32 ounces of marijuana is a lot of marijuana. There is no question about that. There is 32 ounces is 2 kilos. 2 kilos is a lot of weed. So there's no question about the fact that he was selling it, right? But he was given 32 years to life. Now, 32 years to life is punitive. It is not rehabilitative. I'm not advocating prison abolition. That's not what I'm doing. While crime is taking place, the crime needs to be interrupted. I mean, the act right then. The person needs to be told what he is doing needs to be interrupted. The person needs to be explained to why what they're doing is antisocial. And the person needs to be brought back into society. I think that anyone who picks up a gun and kills someone is committing an antisocial act. Some of those acts need to be taken into account from within the mental state of the person who committed the act. We can't, unless we have an actual disability, a mental illness, which needs to be addressed as such. I think that every other form of crime is rehabilitatable. People can be rehabilitated. People can be released into society again. If a society puts someone away for 25 years and or 30 years and the person goes up for parole and they are being denied parole, then there is something wrong with the rehabilitative processes of the specific society, right? Somewhere those attempts at rehabilitation, the system that tries to rehabilitate has gone wrong, is inadequate. So that's why I'm saying that I'm not advocating prison abolition. What I am advocating is a very different way of interrupting crime.
I believe the way I perceive it that you're advocating prevention, which takes us back to education.
I'm advocating both prevention, which engages and contains education, but I'm also advocating for real rehabilitation programs, because prison is not rehabilitation. When you have 1,300 people in 5 blocks in a state prison, and you're only allowing 50 of them to be in the educational program, then you're not rehabilitating anyone. If you don't make psychologists available, if you don't make instruction available, you're not rehabilitating. You're just incarcerating.
These prisons, then, are they a deranged depiction that filmmakers have come up with?
I always try to understand if the filmic representations are a critique of what exists, or if they are actually actively trying to invoke fear and fright. And I don't know what they're trying to do. I know that filmic representations can be looked at literally, and they are being looked at literally. So there are people who really do believe that unless we incarcerate every Black person on earth, the world is going to end up being, as they say, a jungle. There are people who do believe that. I'm hoping that filmmakers actually try to articulate a critique of that, but I'm not convinced. I'm not convinced. I was reading a couple of days ago one of the tweets, or rather I was reading about the public presence in tweets and videos of the new Republican congresswoman from Florida, who actually had said that people were Democrats and people in Black Lives Matter who participated in Black Lives Matter, that they actually killed and ate babies. I mean, this is totally outlandish. This is something that comes from old horror writings that about Jews primarily, and later about runaway Black slaves, that has actually managed to insert itself into, to become part of the general understanding of what minority populations are and do. So to me, it's unfathomable that anyone in the 21st century would actually think that Democrats in Congress, or Democrats with a small D, or Jewish people or Black people actually kill babies and eat them. I mean, how can anyone think of that? How can anyone actually believe, really, that there are people who do that? But I think that the general mistrust against education and the general anti-intellectualism that actually has permeated the world, I would say, again, going back to the Cold War and certainly to the Reagan-Thatcher culture wars, globally has actually made people think more literally than literarily. So it has made people think that a metaphor is not a metaphor, but that a metaphor is actuality, is description. So we find ourselves in that crossroads, right? When we want to think in terms of the future, but we find ourselves in our attempt to, I mean, not our, but in the attempt to present a future metaphorically, we end up having readers who take the metaphors and the symbolism as reality.
I was meant to ask you if in films throughout the decades you think that futuristic prisons are portrayed as better places, or if filmmakers tend to find more creative ways to present them as our worst nightmare, but this information, to say that is shocking, is an understatement. The world is moving forward, and some people, unfortunately, not just a few, insist on looking backward. They still think that sex, sexual orientation, or skin color, to name but a few, is what defines you or renders you as right, wrong, better or worse. That information is beyond disturbing for every possible reason under the sun.
Unfortunately, it's there. Unfortunately, we read it. You know, I always think, why can we not have futuristic writing or futuristic, you know, stochastic engagement? It's actually good, pleasant. Why does it have to be so disturbingly dystopic? Why do we have to think about, in terms of Brazil, you know, the film, and not something else, which of course I realize does not exist, right? We don't have any optimistic, futuristic writing.
Can I answer that?
Please do.
Utopia does not sell. What does that say about us, right?
Right. There was a time, you know, in the 50s, I think, that there were people who thought that technological advancement would actually lead to peace. My father was, he was a mechanical and chemical engineer, and he patented 5 different plastic hoses for liquid transport. And one of it was used, I think still being used, in the Gulf, transporting oil from Iran. It went from Iran to Saudi Arabia, it came to the Gulf. That installation happened obviously before the Iranian Revolution, I think 1973 or 1974. And he always thought that by doing this, the oil wars would be minimized, that the affluence that would come would actually allow those countries to establish universities and lead to the democratization of the governments, and with more affluence, people would actually be able to participate in society better and more equitably. None of this has happened. So that optimism of the people who put technologies together in the 50s and the 60s, who actually thought that that technology would be used peacefully, people who had just come through the real horrors of the Second World War, none of those utopian thoughts have come through. Yes, because they don't sell, but also because I think a frightened population is a compliant population. So the more that these dystopias are being projected, the better chance authority has of establishing itself, as we're seeing now with the new form that the Republican Party has taken. The fear of a dystopian future is the one that is actually allowing for greater authoritarianism.
Think of Plato's Atlantis, for example. It starts as utopia. Everything is perfect from every point of view, only to sink in the end. In modern times, think of Brave New World, Aldous Huxley. Again, it starts as utopia, only to end up as one of the most notorious dystopias ever written. I don't think there has ever been a utopia that was meant to last. Something or someone will wreak havoc in the end. Come to think about it, in real life, there has never been a utopia, so why would people prefer it in literature?
Atlantis is not a democratic experiment, because Plato was deeply anti-democratic. For Plato, democracy always leads to chaos. Aldous Huxley comes at a time when the Marxist experiment has taken place. And this is the figure that actually is missing between Plato and Huxley, right? It's Marx. Marx, who actually did think that he had given all the intellectual and political tools to humanity to create a democratic utopia. And unlike Plato, who actually was deeply mistrustful of the human nature and of the ability of the human being to actualize themselves as best as they could, Marx actually did believe that the human being was a good being, and that if given the right opportunities, the human being would actually be able to show its inherent democracy. And we've seen what has happened, right? Because human beings are inherently self-contradictory. And Bentham says at some point, if I can read this to you, you know, Bentham thinks of the panopticon as something that actually includes all forms of confinement. And he thinks of confinement as including all forms of education and rehabilitation. So prisons, schools, hospitals for Bentham are all part of the panoptical universe. And he talks about discipline. He says that in those places, whether the liberal spirits and energy of a free citizen would be exchanged for the mechanical discipline of a soldier or the austerity of a monk, with the result of this high-wrought contrivance, might not be constructing a set of machines under the similitude of men. right? So all these highly structured, disciplinary, confined spaces, whether it is a school or the army or a prison or a monastery, with its high, as he says, high rot contrivance, all that discipline. So if human beings stopped being self-contradictory, would that not have created a set of machines under the similitude of men?
That reminds me of Charlie Chaplin's last monologue in The Great Dictator.
But, you know, for Chaplin, those were not futuristic engagements, right? Chaplin was describing what had happened and what was happening.
I know that you said you don't really watch horror films, but other than real life, what is your favorite horror film?
My favorite horror film. Okay, so, well, it depends on what one defines as horror.
Something that you found horrific, something that scarred you, something that you will never watch ever again, no matter what.
120 Days in Sodom. That is a film that I never want to watch again. It really scarred me. It has stayed with me. I used to show it to my students. And one of my students, an older student, actually, he was a teacher himself, and he was coming to Columbia to get another degree. He took me aside and said, would you, because my son was 18 at the time, he took me aside and said, would you want your son to watch this film? And that's when I stopped showing that film to my students.
One last question for you.
Mm-hmm.
What is your greatest fear?
That something really awful will happen to my son. It's the only fear I have. When he was little, I had taught him to say that if anyone tried to do anything bad to him, I mean, he was 3 or 4. I had taught him to say, if you do anything to me, my mother will tear you apart limb by limb with her bare hands. So that's my greatest fear.
Thank you very much for your time, and thank you once again for coming on my show.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thanks for the very, very, very interesting discussion. Very good questions. I'm looking forward to hearing more.
I'm glad they spawned amazing answers.
Thank you. Thanks a lot, Kay.
Have a nice evening. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
As we are nearing the end, please give me a review and don't forget to share and subscribe. You can find all of my podcasts, film reviews and analysis on my website, kgpfilmreviews.com. If you also feel like supporting my effort to explore the genre, please feel free to support me on patreon.com/kgpfilmreviews. Any support is much appreciated and valued. This is the first interview that I followed a different approach. The focus was taken from the films and was shifted towards the real horror behind their filmic portrayal. Unfortunately, what we see on TV or the big screen has nothing on a real-life prison, as the latter will always be unfathomably more horrid than the screenwriter's or director's imagination, and no cinematic portrayal will ever be adequate enough to give justice to the feeling of being incarcerated. Solely for entertaining purposes, as we are horror fans, I hope we get to see more realistic or surrealistic depictions on the silver screen. As for the world we live in, I hope prevention becomes the solution to our society's problems, improve the correctional facilities, so finally, maybe one day we find no use for them in our lives. Call me a dreamer, or call it a utopia. So thank you for staying with me all the way. These podcasts are for horror fans who have the passion to delve into the horror genre to its core. Feel free to make requests, suggestions, or ask about anything you would be interested in discovering about the genre and its echoing aftershock to the world we live in. Horror elicits fear through fiction and terror through facts. It is gory and it is psychological. It is caused by supernatural entities as much as it is caused by our deranged next-door neighbor. Horror can haunt our nightmares no less than it can haunt our questionable reality. So remember, the son of Erebus and Nyx always awaits to cross the rivers Styx and Acheron.